Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and today I am absolutely delighted to have Joe Coles, who is the operator of the Hushkit Aviation blog, which many of the readers of Lawyers, Guns, and Money will know from having many links to the site over time. And he is also the author of two volumes of the Hushkit Book of Warplanes. And we're going to start off today talking a little bit about those books because I think they're fantastic works. And then we're going to go into a subject that I find terribly interesting and that is near and dear to his heart, which is Cold War British aircraft. So to start off with, how are you doing today, Joe?
Pretty perky, thanks. Caffeinated and ready to go, I think. Yeah.
Good deal. Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about, could you start just telling us a little bit about the blog, how it happened, and then maybe move into the books?
Sure thing. Yeah. So before the blog, I had been writing about aviation for a while, editing aviation magazines. And I love the subject matter. I find there's sort of nothing more interesting for me than aircraft, and in particular military aircraft. But I found that there were limitations in the way the subject was covered. It always had a certain political bias. It always had a lack of humor. It lent too much on the train spotting side, which I love, but kind of just being too fact focused at the expense of the human side. So there were certain things, that aspects of it, that didn't satisfy me. And I had this obsession with airplanes. So I set about doing this site, which I put an insane amount of work in, interviewing pilots of everything, MiG-25s, Blackbird pilots, doing bizarrely specific top tens, and very lots of parody, lots of silly satire and humorous material in there as well. So it's been a mad obsession, a mad labor of love.
I think that really the most impressive part of the site to me has been the interviews you've been able to get with the pilots. Not really of obscure aircraft, but sometimes of like obscure planes that are obscure within a particular country's service, right? So you'll be able to find a pilot who has, you know, flown MiGs in Indian service at some point, and they'll talk in real detail about those particular variants of that aircraft. I mean, I found that incredibly impressive.
It's thank you. It's been just such a treat to be able to talk to these pilots, and it sometimes takes a load of work tracking them down and then asking the questions that I've always wondered about them. It's been pretty thrilling, to be honest. And sometimes they only came to me on conditions of anonymity, and that's kind of really interesting as well. So there was one guy who wanted to talk about a fault with the F-35. There was and obviously that's a current operational aircraft, so he only did that without a name. And there was another Pakistani fighter pilot who only wanted to come forward anonymously. So yeah, it's been super fun talking to these people.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the books. So I've been following the progress of both volumes of the book. So tell us a little bit about what's in there and what the purpose of the books was.
Well, I approached a few conventional publishers with the book ideas, and because there's so much material on the site, there's about 1,100 articles, and I thought it'd be nice to beautifully edit them, beautifully illustrate them, and put them in physical form. But the publishers kept wanting to dilute it, kept wanting to do airplane books, which are like the existing ones, which I thought was kind of pointless, and I wanted to do it my way. And I spoke to Roland White, author of a very popular Vulcan book, and he said, go to Unbound. These guys, you fund it if you've got some people who are into what you're doing, and then you've got full editorial control. And I thought that was kind of cool. So I set about funding it, and supporters very generously made it happen. And there was so much that I wanted to do a volume two. And I've just started the crowdfunding for the volume two. It's only at 20%, but as soon as it gets to 100%, we can start the nitty gritty of putting it together. So if anyone wants to pre-order that for the Unbound site, they would make me very happy. And hopefully I'll make them very happy with the book as well.
So we'll have links to that available in the Lawyers, Guns, and Money post. So today we're going to talk about something which I guess is eventually going to become an article that you're going to put together, or something you're working on.
Yes, indeed. I think it's going to be out very shortly.
Yeah. Okay. So, and the subject here is the top 10 British Cold War aircraft.
It is the top 10 Royal Air Force Cold War aircraft.
Which is something I know a little bit about, but not enough. And so I'm really looking forward to today's conversation.
Oh, me too. I mean, there's some absolutely beautiful, beautiful machines. And historically, it's such an interesting time. So I guess my first step was was getting likely candidates of what should be in the top 10. And so my first port of call was the famous guys, the poster boys, the Lightnings, the Vulcans. But the more I looked into it, the more I saw that the kind of RAF PR of what, you know, in terms of what they showed frequently in their films and in their magazine adverts weren't necessarily representative of what was the most important historically. So my top 10 isn't all of the poster boys, and it misses some of them. And I think it'll make some people very angry, but I think it's actually a meaningful, I think it's a much more meaningful list. I guess the first question would be, how do you define Cold War? So Britain fought loads of, most of its fighting during the period 1947 to 91, which I think we'll agree is probably generally accepted as the Cold War period, was actually colonial warfare. It was countries wanting independence, Britain saying no and bombing them and getting involved in counterinsurgency. Separating that out from the exercise of deterrence or alleged deterrence against the Soviet Union is very difficult. I mean, even Northern Ireland had occasional Soviet involvement. So the only simple way to do this is to just say it's the period, the Cold War period, 47 to 1991.
All right. So, you previewed those for me, and I know that there are going to be some really interesting questions about it, at least a couple of exclusions here. And so maybe we'll get that to that at the end. But I guess to start off with, because 1947 is a really interesting cutoff, especially in the context of your number 10 aircraft for the Cold War here. So why don't you just dig right into to number 10 of these Cold War British aircraft?
Okie doke. Well, at number 10, we've got the Supermarine Spitfire. Now, that's seen as an aircraft very much of World War II and being very important in the Battle of Britain, where the Royal Air Force defeated the Luftwaffe. And there was an enormous amount of Spitfires produced, and they didn't just evaporate at the end of World War II. They're actually, even though we're at the beginning of the jet age, they were the most numerous RAF type at the dawn of the Cold War. So they'd been replaced at home for that. We wanted the very best fighters protecting the British Isles. So we had Meteor and Vampire jet fighters there, but across the auxiliary units in the United Kingdom and all across the British territories, there were Spitfires everywhere. And there's actually a story that illustrates quite well how important Spitfires are, which is during the 48 Arab-Israeli War, there's five Egyptian Spitfires spot a Israeli base in Palestine. They attack it, but they've got it wrong. It's not an Israeli base, it's a RAF base. Now, the Egyptian aircraft attacking the RAF base are equipped with Spitfires. The RAF base is equipped with Spitfires, and the Israelis they're trying to get are equipped with Spitfires. So, and the Egyptians destroy two Spitfires on the ground. The pilots, interestingly, were actually very hungover because the night before they were about to leg it and they didn't want to hand over their facilities to the incoming Israelis. So they got drunk and trashed their base. So they were not in the best headspace to be attacked. When is the best headspace to be attacked? Yeah. The Egyptians go and they destroy two Spitfires. Eventually, the RAF get a patrol up and they destroy some Egyptian aircraft. There's a later attack where five Egyptian Spitfires are destroyed, three by ground fire and two by British Spitfires. This is 48, I think, actually, as well. This is the last time an RAF pilot in an RAF aircraft shot down an enemy plane in the air. So that's an astonishingly long time, and I think that's very significant. And that alone, for me, would merit its place in the top 10. But there's many more reasons. One is, if you go to the Malayan incident, where there's a communist guerrilla army trying to achieve Malayan independence, and the British and the Commonwealth forces trying to stop them having independence. And it's kind of a British Vietnam War in many ways, and informs, actually, the fighting of the Vietnam War.
One of my questions was going to be, because I took a look at the operators and some of the operators you've mentioned, what the performance of the Spitfire looked like in a counterinsurgency context. Because I know that's what a lot of sort of piston engine fighters had a long afterlife as counterinsurgency specialists in the Cold War.
Great point. And obviously the A1 Sky Raider being an obvious example in American service, they were what they had, really. They had machine guns, which is a good weapon for that. They had notoriously unreliable unguided rockets. They had small bombs. The Spitfire was never a great ground attack aircraft because it couldn't carry that much, but it was easy to deploy, easy to look after. More than that, it was everywhere. Its main thing was its ubiquity. That's what was so useful about it. The Griffin engine had some reliability issues in the kind of very humid parts of Malaya. I would say, in answer to your question, it wasn't an ideal counterinsurgency aircraft. It didn't have the endurance that a good Coyne aircraft has, and it didn't have the armor that a good Coyne aircraft had. So it was kind of okay. Bit too, I mean, it's a Ferrari doing a Jeep's job, really. So it's kind of not really the right thing for that. But for the reasons I've mentioned, that's why I'd put the Spitfire at number 10. Number 9, I would put the Hawker Hunter. This is an early-ish British jet fighter. And I think it's probably fair to compare it to the actor Keanu Reeves, in that it's, because it's so good-looking and it has such impeccable manners, people forgive its limitations. And the Hunter had lots of limitations. The early versions, its guns would jam if they were fired at high altitude. And that was for the first 140 or so aircraft. So that was a big deal. It was very late. And the lateness cost Britain its effectiveness in air defense, and had a huge impact on how British aircraft was seen globally. It was short-ranged and it was slow. It entered service in 1954 with a top speed of Mach 0.93. And then a few months later, the US Super Sabre comes in. That's Mach 1.4. So it's quite slow for the time. And the same year, the Soviet Tu-16 bomber comes in. And that's only marginally slower than the Hunter. So the MiG-19 comes in and would have made mincemeat of the Hunter, certainly in terms of speed. But in its defense, it was kind of nearly idiot-proof. It was hard to crash. It was a very good quality then, because it was a very dangerous time to be a pilot. Huge attrition rates.
Right.
So it generally turned to ground attack, and it was better at ground attack. So there's the Suez Crisis, which I'm sure your listeners will be aware of, when Israel and France and Britain tried to bully Egypt from dictating the use of their own canal. And it got Britain kind of ostracized from the world a little bit. Hunters were used, based in Cyprus, and they flew escort missions with the Canberra bombers. But their range was a bit of an issue. So they didn't do that job terribly well. They were, lots of them, based in RAF Germany, doing air defense in that very important role in Germany. They again involved in the Brunei revolt. In the Borneo confrontation, it's generally the same themes with all these wars. They're these countries fighting for independence, and Britain sending counterinsurgency and bomber aircraft, and the Hunter going in with 3-inch rockets and 30mm cannons. So the Hunter, for those reasons, for its involvement in, as I've said, in Borneo, in Malaysia, in Egypt. It deserves a mention for all those mentions. Oh, and Aden as well, it was involved in. It was used extensively during the Radfan campaign against insurgents.
I'm trying to get my years right here, but it seems like the Hunter entered service just a little bit, a bit after the MiG-17, right? What kind of comparison did you make with the MiG-17? And I'm trying to come up with a good American analog too, but it seems to fit like right in between the Sabre and the Super Sabre in terms of comparison to American aircraft.
That's a great question. When Hunters replaced Sabres in RAF service, some pilots saw it as a retrograde step in some aspects. It wasn't necessarily that much better than the Sabre. The MiG-17 is a kind of a difficult one to compare it to, but in terms of generation, we are looking something that's slightly later than the Sabre, but not as good as the F-100. Sort of comparable with the MiG-17, certainly not as advanced as the MiG-19 performance-wise. So it kind of sits in a kind of awkward in-between place. It started development very early, and if it had come in when it should have come in, it would have been fantastic. If it had come in 3 years earlier, it would have been amazing. But progress was moving pretty quickly, so that those few years meant a lot. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. That's perfect.
Next, we've got the V-bombers. So these are three nuclear bombers, quite large aircraft. And in judging their importance, again, the obvious thing would be to put them in the number one, two, or three slots. But then there's a question of, it all depends on your reading of how meaningful nuclear deterrence is. I had a conversation with my friend, an aviation writer, about this. And the question was, if you think of, does nuclear deterrence work? Because you can say, if I wear a cowboy hat, I don't get attacked by dragons. So since I have my cowboy hat, I haven't been attacked by dragons. Cowboy hats are a good dragon deterrent. And it's impossible to prove that wrong. But going the other way, if you have tens of thousands of people maintaining and manufacturing cowboy hats, wearing cowboy hats, and training to deter dragons, the cowboy hats do become important. So I guess that's my kind of get out of jail argument to include V-bombers, because it's quite subjective whether you'd want to include them or not. And I think they do deserve inclusion. There's the Valiant, the Victor, and the Vulcan. The Valiant is the most conventional, conservative aircraft. The Vulcan's kind of intermediate, and the Victor's the highest tech, highest spec one, and they go into service in the, you know, in the chronology you'd imagine.
So if I could ask, I mean, can you tell me a little bit about the industrial logic of these three different bombers that are entering service? And I know that we're in the 1950s, and everything is revolutionary in the 1950s, and everything that's being built, everything that was built a year before is obsolete, right? But still, for, you know, a relatively small bomber force to have three different bombers enter service and then remain in service for an extended period of time, like, it's something that countries really try to avoid these days, right? Because they want to cut down on maintenance and spare parts and everything else. So what was the industrial logic of having these three different bombers at the same time?
Well, industrially speaking, there's a couple of things going on. One thing is, there's a lot of mouths to feed in terms of companies. There's kind of too many British companies around. So World War II, there's infinite orders for aircraft, resulting in these huge swollen factories and companies needing work. So that's one of them. Another reason is a duplication for the sake of if something goes wrong. These are very important in the perception of the British military planners. These are nuclear bombers, vital for Britain to maintain a place at the top table. So whereas the Vulcan and the Victor were very advanced, there was also they were higher risk. So the Valiant was a lower risk kind of backup solution that was considered very likely to work. Whereas the Vulcan had this very advanced delta wing shape, the Victor this very advanced construction and systems and aerodynamics actually as well. So it was a combination of wanting to feed different countries, having the safety of different types, and also keeping your manufacturers in work.
And of course, I mean, the only one to actually actively serve in combat was the Vulcan, right? Am I wrong about that? Or
The Valiant also did bombing in Suez.
Oh, okay, I see.
Interestingly, when, as you say, the Vulcan's only bombing mission was in the 1982 Falklands War, where it didn't really have the range to do the mission, which is a super interesting subject. So it needed Victor tankers, which was another converter, a V-bomber converted to a tanker to support it. Now, if you had B-52s, which have a much longer range, it would have been much easier to do that. There would have been much less, you know, it was this hugely, madly, madly complicated operation to refuel these Vulcans to do those raids. And if you look at the diagrams of which tankers join and then leave. And it's incredibly complicated. And you think, well, if you had a longer range aircraft, you wouldn't need that. So why are these aircraft so inferior to the B-52 in range? And you see something interesting in that, which is they're really fast. They've got cruising speeds way faster, or faster than airliners now. Cruising speeds faster than the fastest executive jets. And that little increment of speed cost them a lot in terms of those huge compromises to reach that slightly faster speed. I've included them all. It's arguments for which are more significant. You could say the Valiant did more in operational service. The Victor, as a strategic reconnaissance aircraft, was absolutely second to none in RAF service. It was long-ranged. It could map every vessel in the entire Mediterranean Ocean in one morning. It was faster than anything else. It was higher. It was longer-ranged. It was extremely effective. I'm going to clump the V-bombers together as one, and maybe not give them the high ranking that you might expect.
No, I think it's legit. It's also interesting that, you know, as you mentioned, speed there. I mean, this is almost just right before people realize that speed and strategic bombing just isn't all that, right, where we come to the conclusion that their slower bombers can actually do a lot of useful stuff in the strategic.
Certainly, there was changes in our ideas of what made you survivable. Late 50s, early 60s, we've got things like, we've got Soviet surface-to-air missiles being able to hit things very high up, famously Gary Power's U-2, and realizing that altitude didn't necessarily keep you safe. So then there was the idea that if you go slow, you can do standoff weapons. Britain was expecting a US-built missile, the Skybolt, which could fulfill this standoff thing. It didn't happen, and that kind of put the Vulcans in a very difficult position. There was an intermediate weapon, the British Blue Steel, that wasn't very good, but then eventually the deterrent went from the Royal Air Force to just naval submarines. You then see the Vulcan bombers looking for new homes and new roles and not doing much.
Right.
In the later stages. Next, we've got a really cheeky one, which is...
I'll admit, I have never heard of this airplane before just right now, so...
There's a reason you haven't heard of it in the realm of combat aircraft, because it's not really a combat aircraft. It's a little basic trainer, very simple little plane with a little piston engine, a docile little aircraft, built by de Havilland Canada. And it's used to snoop over the Soviet zone of Berlin. It's so... Under a cover story of providing continuation training for aircrew stationed in the British zone, there's a top secret operation called Schooner, maybe Operation Nylon later, to gather intelligence. So 3 times a week, this tiny little plane would snoop on Soviet military installations within the Berlin control zone with only like a handheld camera and 2 lenses, claiming diplomatic immunity, which was a bit iffy. And the Soviets were aware of it. They were really irritated by it. And often Soviet fighters would go and buzz it, and it was shot at by ground fire at least once. So I'm putting this in for all-out balls and daring in it, and also just for all-out chutzpah and cost-effectiveness and being in the right place at the right time. I think the Chipmunk deserves a mention. So that's my number 7 option.
All right, and groovy.
Next, we've got the Gloster Meteor. This was the first non-German jet fighter to enter service. It entered service in World War II. Didn't do a huge amount in World War II, but did usher in the jet age. So it was hugely important. The RAF bought them in massive numbers. They were exported in massive numbers. But much like the kind of British railway system, they suffered from being the first in that they... didn't benefit from swept wings. So the Germans work out swept wings you need once you get into certain speed ranges. Britain didn't necessarily know that until it harvested that information from German research. And this came before that. So it had these big, thick wings that were stopping it reaching transonic speeds and getting in the way. The first major swept wing fighter, well, the Messerschmitt 262 has it. The first post-war one, the F-86, or the first significant one, arguably. It comes along in 47 and outclasses the Meteor completely. Way faster, way better.
Now, I've heard the argument that the 262 represents sort of an interesting dead end, right? It's a pioneer, but it's an engineering dead end for a variety of reasons. Is it accurate to say that about the Meteor, or did they learn lots of lessons from the Meteor and be able to apply that to new engineering?
I might dispute the view on the 262. I mean, if you look at an airliner today, its configuration is swept wings with podded engines on the wings. So in a way, you can see a direct lineage to the 262 in that. So I don't know if I would say the 262 is a dead end. The Meteor, one thing it had, which, it's a really interesting question. I would say no, I'd say it was an important stepping stone, but really the engines were the only really advanced thing about it. The British didn't want to risk putting innovations into the airframe when the engines were already at the cutting edge of technology. So it's essentially a piston-engined airframe. It's a very primitive airframe with very advanced engines. So in that sense, yeah, it is a cul-de-sac, but in other senses, it's not. So that's a really interesting question. I'll have to think about that some more. But it's going in because it's there in such huge numbers. It takes part in the Suez campaign, night fighter versions over Cyprus to prevent Egyptian raids, Malta-based stuff doing armed reconnaissance patrols. It's doing operations in support of Malaya. It's in massive, massive numbers operating. It's also going into Aden as well. And as well as a mass being produced, almost 4,000 produced, it was a very important technology testbed. You've got prone pilots lying down, researching whether that's a good attitude for a pilot to take. Vectored thrust is tested in their ejection seats, new engines. So it's hugely significant for that reason as well. So I definitely think the Meteor deserves a place on the list.
Was it a dangerous aircraft, or was it easy to fly?
It was a dangerous aircraft for several reasons. One was the aircraft were very widely spaced, so far out on the wing. So if one went down, which they frequently did, you would get massive asymmetrical power disparity, and the aircraft would turn to one side very rapidly. Also had very heavy controls, it had navigation, it had a cockpit that was better suited to the 30s. Another reason it was dangerous is when Korea started, Britain increased their intake of pilots by a massive, massive margin. And if you talk to pilots at the time, some of them say you got loads of people coming into the Air Force who shouldn't have come into the Air Force at that time, just because they wanted to bulk up so quickly. But generally, it was a very dangerous time for jet aircraft, and the Meteor was certainly one of those very dangerous early generation jet aircraft. Yeah.
Oh, I think we're ready for number five.
Number five is, right, well, that's an interesting one. So I'm going for the F-86 Sabre, an American-designed aeroplane. Now, I'm going for this. I'm not going for RAF examples. I'm going for examples within the United States Air Force, because 17 RAF pilots completed exchange tours with the US Air Force in the Korean War, and five of these accounted for six MiGs, two of them by one pilot. Hmm. So in terms of air-to-air kills, US Air Force Sabres are the best British fighter aircraft of the Cold War. So yeah, for that reason, I'd put it in. And then you also get the Sabre I would say it's perhaps secondary for this list, going into RAF service. As we mentioned, the Hunter and the Swift were having huge delays, and the Soviet Union had the MiG-15, which was great, really agile, fast, the match of the Sabre, a brilliant aeroplane, and the RAF didn't have anything that could take it on. So it procured Canadian-built Sabres to act as a stopgap. They arrived in the UK, and they were used by the 2nd Tactical Allied Tactical Air Force, As Robert mentioned, the Sabre and the MiG-15 in this time are the fighters to match, and the RAF rushes them into service, and they serve in large numbers. 430 are serving from 53 to 56, which is a very critical period in the Cold War. So for those two reasons, I would put the F-86 in. It's number six, isn't it?
Number five.
Okie doke. So next we have the Avro Lincoln and the Avro Shackleton, which are essentially in lots of ways the same aircraft. So I'm going to include them as one thing. I guess that the thing about this story is it kind of reveals so much about what was going on in British air power and British politics in general. You can learn a lot about the story of British air power from the story of the Shackleton. So it spans a very long time. In the 1930s, there's a bomber requirement, which is met by the Manchester, which is this kind of lackluster underpowered aircraft, which is then perfected by doubling the engines into the Lancaster, which is the best British bomber of the war and one of the best aircraft of any nations of the war. And this Lily was gilded further as the Lincoln, which is a post-war bomber. They beefed up the Lancaster. They wanted to make a Mark IV much bigger, more powerful, and it eventually became so different, it earned a new name and was called the Lincoln. The British bombers are named after British cities, so it's not named after President Lincoln, it's named after the city of Lincoln, following the tradition of the Lancaster and the Manchester. It missed the Second World War. Nearly 600 were built, which gives you an idea of, this is a heavy bomber, 600 being built. There's such a huge industrial base looking for work that 600 are built. It takes part in Kenya against the Mau Maus. There's an insurgency in Kenya, and Britain crushes it very, very brutally with torture, mass executions, concentration camps, and drops, I believe, almost 6 million bombs on Kenya in this time. And that's done by the Lincoln largely, which is a huge, very unpleasant effort, but very significant.
Now, in terms of performance, how would you? I mean, it seems a little bit after, but a rough contemporary of the B-29. I mean, how would you compare it in terms of performance with the Super Fortress?
Well, it's the B-29 was a new concept. The B-29 is aerodynamically very slick, pressurized from the outset. You could argue the B-29 is almost the first modern aeroplane, whereas the Lincoln is a pimped up old aeroplane. So in terms of it's not as high flying as the B-29. I imagine it'd be inferior in several categories, but it's basically squeezing the last bit of juice out of an old design. And you can see an idea about comparing the two is that Britain still wanted B-29s a couple of years after Lincolns had come in. So that gives you an idea. The B-29 certainly had some things the Lincoln didn't, certainly as a nuclear bomber and a nuclear compatible bomber. The Lincoln was also in Berlin flying reconnaissance flights. And in 53, one was shot down over Lundberg in Germany by MiG-15s. So it's hugely significant and often overlooked actually as well. So the Lincoln, I think, definitely deserves a place. Like I say, in the Mau Mau Rising, it's got 6 million bombs, part of a total of 50,000 tons of British bombs dropped in between 53 and 55. They were used in border patrols in Bahrain, various other places, including Aden. And then the Lincoln is taken. This is slightly preceding the combat we were just talking about, and turned into an anti-submarine warfare aircraft. Long loiter time, big old bomb bay, very strong structure. And it does this quite well, does this for a long time. Then Britain loses its aircraft carriers in the late 70s. It loses an AWACS, an airborne early warning capability in the 70s, and something needs to be created to fill that need. So they get ancient World War II Avenger period radars and put them on the Shackleton as an AWACS. And this is crazily archaic. It's going like whatever it is, 400 miles an hour. And it could be facing Su-27s, MiG-29s, MiG-31s. And it's doing it with a crappy radar and way too slow. And it's and this goes right until the end of the Cold War. I think it gets replaced, is it 91 when the Century comes in? But for that reason, the Shackleton and Lincoln story straddle the entire Cold War period. So certainly do deserve a mention.
Now, it's interesting to me that, that both, I mean, the British and the Soviets have this experience here of using bombers as maritime patrol aircraft or converting them to roles that are that have a maritime component. And this is really something that the Americans can never manage, right? Because just, I think, just because of the weird service structure that the Americans have, right? Like the after the B-24 is used in an anti-submarine role in World War II, you don't have Air Force bombers being converted to that kind of role like you have in both Britain and in the Soviet Union, which you know turns the Tu-95 or 195 the Tu-95 into a maritime aircraft as well.
Yeah, and I think part of that comes down to force structure in that Britain had coastal command, which is essentially a land-based naval air force, and the Soviets also go for a land-based naval air force, or pretty much all land-based. So I think I think you've nailed it there, which is that comes down largely to force structure. You know, there's the friction between services where they don't want to become dependent on the aircraft of another service. So there's a few things going on there. But this certainly was an example of that, of a bomber becoming a maritime patrol aircraft. And it's often a happy evolution, because you have these massive bomb bays which you can use for different things, lots of space, lots of structural strength, and hugely importantly, massive loiter time as well. So it was quite good for its time, the Shackleton, good in the anti-submarine warfare role, but for the airborne early warning thing, it's really out of its depth, massively out of its depth.
And I can't imagine want that. I would imagine if you could find somebody who crewed it, was still crewing it in 1991, that would be a fascinating interview to have at some point, right? Somebody who, in this ancient aircraft.
I haven't got hold of someone myself yet, but I've certainly read interviews with them, and it's a very eccentric operation. I mean, and they're very soulful, characterful, complicated mechanical machines operating in the digital age, and it's... I think for all the reasons listed, definitely want the Shackleton and the Lincoln in. Number three is the de Havilland Venom. So this story starts off with the vampire. So if you imagine a kind of jet-powered P-38 Lightning, where it's got these two twin booms instead of a solid fuselage, which looks really cool. And for the jets, it was useful because it meant the jet had less internal room to travel past, so it lost less power, and you had a less heavy rear fuselage. The Vampire was first generation, flew it madly earlier, might be 1943, but really early. Sparkling agility, heavy firepower, great high altitude performance, but like the Meteor, it's held back by having a straight, thick wing. So it's clearly got more potential. So they think, what about if we replace its Goblin engine with a more powerful Ghost engine, sweep the wings back, add those beautiful tip fuel tanks, beef it up, make it bigger. And the result is something 50% heavier and a really excellent, excellent machine. The Venom flies in 49 and the speed has leapt up. Whereas the first Vampire, what was the speed of the first Vampire? I'd guess something like 480, is it? Something like that. And the speed has gone up to 640 miles an hour, which is pretty good at that time. It becomes the kind of British Empire's thug, like always looking for trouble, always there to do it. And it, in the Malayan emergency, it conducts more than 300 strikes and it does a lot. It also bombs Egypt, the Operation Musketeer during the Suez Crisis. Again, the Aden situation. I don't know, you've heard the word emergency for a lot of these wars. Mm-hmm. Apparently the reason the term emergency is used is because an insurance companies refuse to pay out if something's called a civil war. So the planters in Malaya, in the Malayan situation, the rubber planters said, please, can newspapers and governments only call it an emergency, because otherwise we won't get any insurance money. And so you see these series of euphemistically named emergencies, which is just insurance fraud, really.
Right.
So in Amman, it does attacks. The Jebel Akhdar war there. It's all around causing trouble and doing really well at this stuff it's doing. So for that, I'd put that at number three. And it's also often overlooked, but I would say it's hugely important type.
Well, it's a beautiful, visually striking aircraft, so.
Absolutely beautiful. The Vampire is kind of cute. And I've been up to vampires in museums, and you can stand towering over a vampire, this kind of baby-like thing. But the Venom is this sleek, mean, sinister, cool machine. Beautiful. And also carrying on the legacy of the world of de Havilland's Mosquito, which is you have small, light, very fast, minimal aircraft rather than making them huge. So number two is going to be the English Electric Canberra. Britain was fantastic at early jet propulsion, led the world, wasn't so good at knowing what to do with this jet propulsion, but it was good at the engines. So you had the issues with the Meteor again, with its straight wings, something called the Supermarine Attacker, which was rubbish. The Hunter was too late. The Swift was a basket case. There was lots of jets that had loads of potential that didn't make it. But there was one exception, or one notable exception, which was the Canberra. The company, it's kind of a weird company that made it, because they'd been just licensed producing other people's designs in the war. The last thing they'd made was a really cute wooden flying boat in the 1920s. And suddenly, seemingly, they come from nowhere and make the best bomber in the world. It's very, very fast. It can fly very, very high. And it's got the agility of a fighter. It gets a load of world records. It gets 3 altitude records, 24 point-to-point world records. It gets to New York in 6 hours. It's incredible. It's an absolutely brilliant aeroplane, relying on a very big wing, a very simple design. Everyone loves them. NASA still flies them today, which is an idea of how good they are. And the RAF loved them. And they bought an amazing thing of this. They bought 782 aircraft. And they equipped over 55 British squadrons, and its service lasted for 55 years. Its fighter-like performance was to do with the fact that it had this very big wing and lots of power, so it had a low wing loading. And it was actually originally intended very early on as a fighter bomber, so it had that fighter-like quality. Huge range, huge versatility, simple, strong design. Way lower wing loading than the B-47. And the Canberra, it can just do whatever you ask of it, and it can fly insanely high. We come back to Malaya, and as part of Operation Fire Dog, the RAF operation there, the Canberra's carrying this big bomb load, 6 big 1,000-pound bombs, and it's proving, like, devastating there. Again, in Suez, it goes in. A funny thing, which, again, a story that reoccurs across the British Cold War period, is British aircraft fighting on both sides in the same war. And in the Falklands War, which you mentioned, both the UK and Argentina had Canberras, and there were several wars where the Canberras were on both sides. In 1950, there's a big meeting of reconnaissance experts, and they come to RAF Benson for a big conference. Because they're all worried, because they're hearing that the Soviet Union is developing surface-to-air missiles that can shoot down aircraft at 46,000 feet. The RAF at this time has reconnaissance aircraft which are really getting on, the Spitfires and Mosquitoes, and they're utterly inadequate. They just get completely mullered by these new defensive weapons. The US had RB-45s and RB-47s, which could just about get away with it, and the RB-36, which couldn't fly far enough. They needed something, and also the RB-36 was a huge thing that was massively conspicuous to radar. So they needed something new, and the Canberra was suggested. And with a slightly bigger wing area, a bit more power, and recce equipment, it became this incredible photo reconnaissance and other sensor reconnaissance platform. So essentially a British U-2, but with a bit more internal volume. So it's a bit more flexible than the U-2, not quite as high flying, but that keeps on going throughout the entire Cold War. That's retired in, what is it, 2003, maybe?
I thought it was 06, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah, 2006. So the PR-9 really keeps going, straddles all of the Cold War. So I certainly think the Canberra, for all those reasons, deserves to be included.
And so we're now down to number one. And I'm really curious, because I'm fascinated by how many people are going to get number one wrong here, who are going to guess wrong. But go ahead and give us your number one.
Yeah, the number one might be a surprise. It's not the Lightning. It's not the Javelin. It's not the Phantom. It's the de Havilland Comet, and to a lesser extent, Nimrod. Now, this rests on a very important fact, which is that, well, or opinion rather, that the greatest British victory of the Cold War was in avoiding involvement in the Vietnam War, which could very easily have happened. And the Comet was one of the aircraft that took Prime Minister Wilson to the United States with Defense Secretary Healy to say no to joining the war, which irritated Johnson. And Johnson was kind of seeing the UK as these kind of ungrateful, pompous people who, you know, were asking too much from the special relationship. And then here they were, they weren't even going to supply moral support or material support to the Vietnam War. So for that reason, I think it's definitely the most important Cold War type. It's in a symbolic role here, but I guess quite a few of the other aircraft are in a symbolic role. But there's other reasons why the Comet is involved. The Comet was the first jet airliner, so it's hugely, hugely significant in that sense. As well as that, it was converted into the Nimrod, which served as both a maritime reconnaissance attack aircraft and a reconnaissance aircraft. Now, I spoke to someone who was deeply involved in Cold War aircraft development, and I said, what do you think is the most important RAF reconnaissance type? And he said, I'd consider the Comet and the Nimrod aircraft of 51 Squadron to be the most important assets, and I'm not at liberty to discuss why. But they were certainly doing very important things, and the Nimrod R1 was excellent. Kind of, I guess, in some ways, comparable to the American RC-135. Essentially, that's my number one. Oh, also, in anti-submarine warfare, the Nimrod is brilliant, and it carries on for a long time. Again, straddles the Cold War, and it's doing this very important work, countering potential submarine threats. So that would be my number one.
All right, so the obvious questions are going to come here. The exclusion, I'm thinking just two in particular, right? And one of them you already mentioned, which is the Lightning. But also, I think people are going to ask questions about the Harrier, right? I mean, why we don't see the Harrier here? So yeah, if you can answer those objections preemptorily.
Okay, well, I've considered the Lightning more than I've considered the Harrier. So the Harrier objections I'll have to consider more on the hoof. But the Lightning, I think, is... goes back to what I was saying earlier about that there were certain poster boys of the war, of the Cold War. And I think we're so used to seeing these images and the aircraft are so charismatic and exciting that we imagine that they're very important, though this is not necessarily the case. So I'll say the reasons for not include the Lightning. First of all, it was never used in combat. Second, it was ineffective for most of its career. Third, it's only produced and used in quite small numbers. There's 337 produced, and that's including exports. So the RAF had less than that. To put that in perspective, if you take something that's not even that well-known, like the Saab Draken, a Swedish fighter aircraft, twice as many are made. Now, if you compare it to its other peers, the French Mirage 3, the Soviet Su-15, the American Phantom and F-104 MiG-21, it's minuscule. It's not relevant for very long at all. It enters service in 1960, and it's very quickly apparent that its terrible endurance, its terrible weapon load, make it inappropriate for countering Soviet bombers and reconnaissance aircraft. The American gets RAF gets Phantoms, F-4 Phantoms in 1969, and it's totally, so that's only 9 years after service entry, it gets totally outclassed. The American aircraft's got four times the weapons, three times the endurance, twice, maybe more, the radar range. And I spoke to a RAF Lightning pilot about this because I didn't want to knock it without doing my homework. So I decided to speak to a Lightning pilot, and he said he believed it was unnecessary beyond about 74, and he thought it was kept on just to maintain numbers. I think with all those damning points, that's enough to not include it, the Lightning.
Right. No, I think that's fair. I mean, because, I mean, the Soviet bombers are going to be launching long-range missiles anyway, so the Lightning barely has the range to go to their standoff launch points.
Yeah,
right?
It's got essentially, if it's lucky, it has a chance to have a one-pass attack on these bombers, which if it can reach them, which it may not be able to, and it's refueling all the time, if it's lucky. And then it's using weapons with a very low probability of kill, and it's only got two of them. So the chance that it could do anything is low. And it's also such a hot aircraft that there's quite a high attrition rate as well. Maybe not more than other aircraft of its generation, but it's performance over everything else. And it was only ever considered a kind of stopgap. But yeah, for those reasons, for charisma and looks, I would definitely put it in the top 10, but for in terms of importance, I think it's hard to argue the case for it. Was there other honorable mentions you were? So was there other aircraft you were surprised that weren't included?
Well, just the Harrier. The Harrier is the other one that I think people will be surprised.
Well, the Harrier
about.
Again, it doesn't really do anything in the Cold War in terms of actual fighting. It comes in, when does it come into service? I think 69. Enter service. It's got a very low war load. It's probably not going to survive very long in West Germany. So at both a tactical and strategic level, it doesn't seem to offer very much. And it also is responsible for the deaths of lots of pilots. And though it did influence the F-35B, you could say the Harrier is a cul-de-sac, certainly in the exact propulsion method. Or in the exact vertical lift method, it's a cul-de-sac. So in terms of strategic, tactical, and technological importance, I'd say it's hard to put the Harrier on the list as well.
Right. I mean, I think the argument would be that it enabled sort of the late Cold War British carrier force, which was, you know, was strategically significant in terms of sort of British naval power in the 1980s.
Carrier force, so we're talking largely about Royal Air Force Harriers. The Harriers were significant.
Right.
There was a contingent of RAF Harrier GR3s deployed in the Falklands. So that would be the strongest or one of the strongest cases for inclusion. But again, the Sea Harrier was doing most of the work there. So I would probably put the Sea Harrier on the Royal Naval Fleet Air Arm list, but not necessarily the Harrier on the RAF list.
Okay, well, Joe, this has been fantastic. Do you have anything else you wanted to add for any other objections you wanted to get in front of that you think our listeners might have?
I'm sure most people will disagree with what I said. I think there's fair reasons for this. It's a balancing act, and top 10s never really reflect reality. It's just a sort of discussion starting point. But I think these are interesting. I'd stand by this list. B-29... also could have potentially made the list, the Sycamore helicopter potentially. I would encourage readers to check out the hushkit.net site, which is dependent on donations to keep going. And like I say, we've got 1,100 articles there, great writers, fascinating interviews, loads of top tens on there, and pre-order the book from unbounds.com, Nashkit Book of Warplanes, volume 1 and 2. Oh, we sell cool t-shirts and stuff as well on Redbubble. But yeah, that's my top 10. I don't know. What do you think about it?
I think it's great. I think that you got a good argument for all of them on there. I mean, there's nothing. I think you have a good logic for excluding the lightning. And so this has been fantastic. It's been a delight to meet you. I'm glad that most of our listeners will have the opportunity. For our listeners, all the links to both the Hushkit blog and also to the two Unbound volumes that Joe has talked about, those are going to be available in the post. And so please take a look.
My pleasure, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.